The first thing I heard was, "This is Amelia Earhart." And that startled me. She said it several times. And I recognized that voice when I heard it. She was hurting, you know, there was something terribly wrong. You could hear him, but you couldn't make out what he was saying. But you could tell that she was trying to keep him away from the radio. And they'd wrestle around when he would try to get on.
I'm Christy Stevens, and this is Strangeful Things.
Brett. Go.
Yeah. Triggered.
Every time I hear CNAV's creepy voice, I get triggered. I'm like, oh my God, where is she? She's under the table.
Mom mode. Mom mode.
Right, exactly.
No, I totally get it. Welcome to Strangeful Things. I am Christy Stevens, your host for the evening or afternoon or morning or whenever you're listening to this.
That's right.
I have with me the lovely Jen Martinelli.
Woohoo!
The fantastic B-Nev.
What?
And Acadia Einstein.
Oh, I see. That's how it's going to be?
Fantastic.
Adolf.
We're starting it up. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yes.
No respect.
Zero.
Word. See how it's going to be.
Well, he was minus a crown earlier, so that's what true. Happens.
That's true. No crown, no... Well, he had a shiny mask, so he had a little bit of bling, so...
Yeah, well...
Alright, so... Not only are we going to be strange tonight, we are going to be topical for once.
Ooh!
Because if you haven't heard... The History Channel aired a 2-hour special. I believe it was called Amelia Earhart, New Evidence. And the special was... I watched it. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. And nice. Then I went and did some research. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you guys up front that most of... The special centered around a photograph taken in Saipan in the North Mariana Islands that was supposed to show a Caucasian woman and a Caucasian man amid Native Islanders and Japanese. And they had facial recognition people analyze this photo to see if it could have been Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, her navigator. And these people came away and said, yes, it's very likely, like the same build, the same, you know, facial structure, you know, it's a blurry photo, but we feel good about it. I would go to court and all this other stuff. Turns out shortly after the special aired, a blogger and Japanese military history buff named Kota Yamano published a post showing the image in question was published in a Japanese travel book in 1935, which was 2 years before Amelia Earhart disappeared.
Oh!
I had heard that. That is, yeah, that's what now, I had heard.
The picture is one of many in a travel book titled something in Japanese that I will absolutely slaughter if I try, which translates to... The Lifeline of the Sea, My South Sea Memoir, South Sea Archipelago Photo Book. And I actually have the link to where you can view it online if you so choose. So we'll put that in on the site so that people can look at it themselves and try to read the Japanese.
So wait a
that's
minute.
That's awesome.
You're saying that the Japanese had perfected a magical time travel camera?
Yes. Yeah.
of things happened until 2 years later?
That is one theory.
That's exactly what she said. No, thank you for posting the link, because I haven't been able to keep up with it since I had heard that someone had said, oh, that was from a, you know, article earlier. So as far as I was concerned, I was like, yeah, whatever. Come on, Japan, please.
Right. No, it's Japan, I don't speak Japanese, so I have to rely on the translation that this guy says it is. But no one has come forward to say that's not what it says. So
right.
Until then, you know,
well,
you kind of have to take him for his word.
Well, and not only that, but you can't. I mean, numbers are numbers. They're, you know, they're the same language for everybody. So the date of the article is accurate, correct?
I mean, or the date of the book publication is accurate.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So yeah. So with that said, sad trombone. Because I was all excited about it. I was like, yes, I believe.
But then I was like, oh no.
Sad trombone.
Yeah. Exactly. So, this gives us an opportunity to talk about the evidence surrounding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, though, because there is a lot of stuff that I didn't know. And it's kind of spooky. So it's right up our alley, and I thought you guys would enjoy it.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
So let's start with the facts, ma'am.
All right.
Just the facts.
Exactly.
Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were on a flight to circumnavigate the globe as close to the equator as possible. This occurred in 1937. I got my dates wrong. The book was in 1935. They disappeared after taking off from Ley, New Guinea, bound for Howland Island, which is a tiny island in the middle of the Pacific. The USS Itasca was standing by at Howland Island, and the USS Ontario was stationed midway along the route in order to guard Earhart's plane from the Japanese and relay weather information to Pearl Harbor so it could be sent to Earhart so that she would know, you know, what to expect weather-wise. Amelia was flying a two-engine aluminum Lockheed Electra 10E. The passenger seats had been removed to make room for two huge fuel tanks to hold fuel in reserve.
And urine buckets.
Oh, jeez.
Yes. From our live pre-show. Probably. So
minimum of two buckets.
Right, because nobody wants to reuse the bucket.
No,
that's right.
So July 2nd, 1937 was the last time Earhart and Noonan communicated verbally with the Coast Guard ship, the Itasca. Okay?
All right.
Now, I'm just going to run through all the stuff that's known first, and then we'll get into the theories about what actually happened and why they think that.
I'm raising my hand, but you can't see because it's radio.
Yes.
Okay.
So.
You in the back.
Yes. this whole flying around the world thing, it wasn't like it was nonstop.
Mm-mm.
Like when Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic, the whole point of that was the nonstop part. This was just, I'm going to take a bunch of small airplane flights in a row.
Yes.
Not well, to make it sound worse, but you know what I mean.
In the 30s, they didn't have a plane that was capable of actually going more than, like, I think it's 4,000 miles. And that's if it was modified to have extra fuel tanks and stuff, which hers was. So she had a higher range of distance on her plane than normally that plane would have.
Right. Plus, you know, they have to basically strip the plane down to nothing in order to make it as light as possible in order to fly as far as possible.
Right. So, and that actually comes into play is the weight of the plane and the fuel and everything else.
So all you assholes out there that are worried about why you have to only have your bag be so many pounds, there's a fucking reason. So deal
with it. That's right. You won't get off the island.
That's right.
So, basically, to sum it up, as Inigo Montoya would say, there is too much. I will sum up. As Earhart and Noonan were getting closer to Howland Island, like everything was fine, they took off. Well, let me start over. They took off from Lae, New Guinea, and exactly what B'Nev said, you know, was true, because when they took off in New Guinea, the plane, they were weighted down with fuel and they had, you know, water and like all kinds of stuff. And then the two people, and the plane literally, like, the only footage, like the last footage of the plane taking off, shows it like get to the end of this like grass runway at the edge of the island. And it literally had not left the ground when it was like 50 feet from the end of the island still. And so it finally leaves, and it dipped again afterwards because it was so weighted down with fuel to make sure that they could make this jump. But at that time they were over the water, so they kind of dipped down and then rose back up. So it was kind of a dramatic takeoff anyway.
Especially for that time period. I mean, it's probably the same as like when the Spruce Goose was trying to take off.
Exactly. And honestly, one of the letters that was written to the United States Coast Guard or somebody in the government after she disappeared, you know, everybody was giving their accounts of what happened to try to figure out if there was any leads or any evidence that would come out. And this one guy said that after she took off, like all the pilots in New Guinea were like, totally like, yes, that was an amazing takeoff. She did so great. Like they had nothing but praise for the way that she actually took the plane off, considering its load and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they fly through, they're on course as they were getting closer to Howland, eventually arriving at what Amelia thought was the approximate location of Howland Island. Due to a lack of two-way communication, she could not get a bearing on the USS Itasca. And she could not get the USS Itasca to get a bearing on her and transmit that information back. There are records where the people on the Itasca, like the radio operators, like kept records of what everybody said and, you know, that kind of thing. So she asked several times if she could get a bearing, if they could, you know, speak to her, or she told them that she couldn't see them and she wasn't sure, you know, where she was going. And she wasn't panicking, but she was starting to get concerned because she didn't have visual on the ship, didn't have visual on the island, and from what she said, she could not hear the ship radio when they tried to contact her.
So are you saying that they were talking back to her, but she couldn't hear them?
Yes, they were responding back to her, but her responses sounded as though, like she actually said in one response, she said, you know, we're 100 miles off and I cannot hear you. I need you to contact me and get a bearing and send it to me so that we know where we are. And that's paraphrased, but it's very close to what she said.
Right.
So there's also evidence that there's different evidence than this, that there was a problem with the radio or the antenna on the Itasca that prevented them from hearing her clearly and possibly prevented them from transmitting so that she could hear them.
Oh boy.
She actually asked them twice for her to contact her with a bearing or to radio her so she could take a bearing on them, but she, from her responses, she wasn't able to hear anything useful. So after giving her position as, quote, 157-337, which are coordinates, and saying, quote, we are running north and south, the Itasca received no further useful voice communication from them. So, this was July 2nd, or the evening. It was the evening of July 2nd. And I've got a whole bunch of notes here about the stuff that they tried to do to get in touch with her. They actually sent several requests. They sent numerous voice signals to her on one particular wavelength or one particular kilohertz band. 3105, I believe, was the band that she was using during the daytime. And so that was the band that the Itasca actually apparently had voice capability on. And so that's the one that they were trying to use. And so they sent a voice signal to her requesting her to send a series of long dashes after they had not heard from her to get her to respond.
I'm sorry, is that Morse code when you say long
dashes? Yeah, like long dashes, like they had, like the radio had a button, and like it's very simple. You press the button and you speak. And so, but it would make a noise whenever it activated.
So that
started transmitting.
And so that's kind of an old way of, if you can't hear anybody and anybody can't hear you, supposedly that's a way to communicate for, yeah, especially back then.
Well, it basically makes it an intelligent response.
Right.
So, okay. And there was no other probable source of anything out there at the time, because everybody was listening for her.
Right.
It was a huge deal.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So after she was out of brain, after she was out of communication for, like, I believe it was just over an hour, they were pretty sure that she had gone down, but they didn't know where. So they sent a voice signal to her on 3105 kilohertz requesting her to send a series of long dashes, which would be like beep, 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 you know. And so shortly after that, the Coast Guard commander of the Hawaiian sector relayed to the Itasca that an army radio station in Oahu had heard a signal consisting of a series of long dashes on or around 3105 kilohertz. What they think is that it was a delayed response to the request, or it could have been one of a series of responses to the request. Okay? All like, right. Imagine that she had to put the plane down, but they weren't dead and they weren't underwater and she can't respond right then, but she heard them. And so she waited until, you know, it was safe and then sent her message, or she sent several of them and this is the only one they heard. It was like 2 hours later.
So the idea is that maybe she crashed and she was somehow, what, kidnapped or something, or in some sort of trouble?
Oh, you have no idea.
Oh, why?
Wait,
we're gonna get into that.
Clearly.
But what did she? I mean, they're not. We know she was in a plane in the air,
right?
So
before she disappeared, she had radioed when she was trying to get a hold of them and told them that she couldn't hear them.
Right.
She had said that she was running low on fuel.
So I guess what I'm trying to separate things into is there's the camp of she crashed and died.
There's
the camp of she crashed and lived, and then I guess there would be another camp of she didn't crash.
You're getting ahead of me.
I know that there's going to be fact like things behind all this. I'm just trying to get, like, because I had never heard anything other than, you know, she disappeared and assumed crashed, because if your goal was to fly around the world, why would you not?
Yeah.
Why would you stop it?
So I will, I'll humor you and Let me find the list. All right, so.
Stop getting ahead of her, Acadia.
Long story short,
I'm so insightful.
God, Jesus.
Long story short, and I will tell you, there are several theories. There's one theory that she, and we're not done with like all the evidence that they survived the crash. Okay.
Sure.
Because some of it's pretty crazy. So there's one theory that says that she put the plane down on, what was it called? You got me all discombobulated.
I was just trying to like frame the discussion into this. There's really only three ways that, since we know it wasn't successful trip around the world, that there were really only three buckets you could be in. You know what I mean? Like,
main buckets, but then like you've got like smaller buckets inside one of the buckets.
100%. I'm just like, so the book had been like my whole life, and everything I had ever heard was that the she crashed and died bucket really was where everybody had put all their shit. So,
well, that's an umbrella theory for sure. The question is where the plane came down and when she died for that bucket.
Because obviously there was confusion about where she was because there was...
Yeah, they couldn't seem to get a bearing on her, and she couldn't hear them. So, you know. So one of the theories that is... the main theory for the, where is it? The crap. Let me go home. The main theory for the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, which is the organization that has done expeditions to the Pacific and gone to the islands and taken cadaver dogs and, you know, looked for airplane parts, the whole thing. Like, they've been doing this for a long time. Their main theory is that she landed the plane safely on Gardner Island, which had a lagoon in the middle, and it was like this ring kind of reef.
Oh my God, like Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. And so it, but like, not quite as jungly. So
not quite as jungly.
their main theory right now, their working theory, is that she went down at Gardner Island at low tide because when she came through, it would have been probable that it was low tide and the reef would have been exposed and it would have been perfect to land an airplane on without going into the water. There are other theories that... that they landed somewhere else on a different island and were captured by the Japanese and brought to Saipan, which was where the Japanese political prison was after World War I. That the plane was actually held at Aslido Airfield on Saipan, that Earhart and sometimes... in some versions, Fred Noonan were both incarcerated at the Garapan Jail on Saipan, that the U.S. government knew about it and they didn't do anything about it because the only way they knew was through surveillance that the Japanese didn't know they had, and so they didn't want to reveal that they had this surveillance, so they just left her.
Oh.
Seriously, fuck Japan, though. Like...
yeah,
like seriously, like it's oh yeah, no, and of course it's been, you know, 70-80 years, but we're never still gonna fucking own up to it, you know what I mean? Like, just yeah, say that that's what actually happened. They're like, oh no, it wasn't.
Japan has staunchly opposed the idea that they captured either one of them or held either one of them or had the plane or anything.
Well, that's why I didn't necessarily believe the fact that that person came out and said, no, this is from an article, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
From so much longer ago.
Right. No, I had to track down the book. I wanted to see it. And I found the book, but I don't read Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Well, get it together, Christy. Well, next time, learn Japanese in a week.
Really? You ought to fucking try a little harder then. You could have learned Japanese.
Oh my gosh. This afternoon.
That's right.
Yeah. So, let's see, where was I? Da, 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 da.
This is a lot more about Amelia Earhart than I ever knew.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That's what I knew.
Seriously,
she was
like
a lady who flew planes.
It's a lot of stuff. And so, yeah. All right. In the hours after the Itasca lost contact with Earhart, they attempted numerous times to communicate with her in Morse code because the signal they were receiving was so weak. In fact, after requesting via voice that Earhart respond with several dashes to confirm it was her, dashes were heard by the HMS Achilles, which also heard the Itasca's request. Itasca's failure to hear the dashes as clear as Achilles implies a problem with Itasca's antennas or receivers, which we covered earlier.
Right.
Here was the problem with all of that. Like, you know, you got to give it to them. Like, they're trying to get a hold of her. They're trying to think of any way that they can get a hold of her. They're trying to communicate with Morse code instead of with voice, because the voice comes over and you can tell it's a voice, but it's too fuzzy and you can't tell what it's saying, or it cuts in and out. Problem was that Earhart and Noonan, neither one of them knew Morse code.
I was just about to say that. I was like, why didn't they try to do that earlier?
Neither one of them knew it well enough to be able to either transcribe or recognize a message.
That's a problem.
That's kind of a problem.
Yeah. That's a problem.
Later, like a couple days later, they did send out a very poorly, what was the word that they described? It was a poorly done Morse code signal that like they figured out what it was supposed to say, but it was like not done
quality.
Well. And they think that what happened is that they actually had a book on the plane somewhere about Morse code. And so they literally had to write down dashes and dots and then transmit it.
Well,
and
yeah.
So,
but
like,
what else would you do?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of these radio operators just knew it. Like, they didn't need, like, some of them didn't even need a book at this
right.
point because they did it so often.
Right.
But the problem was that, like, if you don't know Morse code, you can't sit there with a book and have a Morse code signal come in because you're going to get lost really quickly. And you're like, was that a letter? Where are we? I don't even know. Like, you know, you would panic.
Yeah, you can't sit there and look it up.
Yeah, you don't have time.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
you
just be like,
you can't Google Morse code back then either.
No.
Right. There was no Google. Surprising.
There was no Google.
That's horrible.
Free Google. So let's see. Basically between July 2nd and July 6th, there were several times that they heard long dashes, like sets of four, or they would hear a carrier, what's called a carrier signal, which doesn't have any voice on it. Like, there's nothing useful that you can hear on it, but it means that something is transmitting. And most of that it had to do with the weather that was going on at the time, interference from the atmosphere, all kinds of stuff. And so, and plus the Itasca's stupid antenna.
Right.
Stupid Itasca.
So they continued to try on July 3rd, July 4th, July 5th. They continued to try to get a hold of her. They continued to, you know, listen. Like, everybody knew, you know, by the fifth and the sixth that she had gone down and she was missing. And so all these amateur ham radio operators and shortwave radio operators, you know, because radio was the big thing in the 30s.
Right.
If you had an antenna strong enough, you could dial in to all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And I'm about to science you up with Ooh. The reason that you could dial into all of this stuff. So, because I wanted to know, I was like, why were some people able to hear her and some people weren't?
Right.
So, the kind of radio that Amelia had on her plane often created extra signals called harmonics at multiples of the original frequency. Okay. So you remember 3105 was the frequency that she had been transmitting on. And I misspoke earlier. 3105 was this frequency she was using at night. And during the day, she was using 6210. Because during the day, the 3105 didn't work quite as well, and vice versa. So the harmonics that these create can bounce off the ionosphere and travel a long way.
Right.
There's a radio expert named Bob Brandenburg that believes that Amelia's normal daytime frequency of 6210 kilohertz would generate harmonics that could actually reach the state of Florida from the Pacific.
Oh.
Yep.
That's pretty far.
So, and the thing is, like, it just happens that, you know, when it comes up and it bounces, it just comes down in, you know, the places where people said that they heard her.
Right.
Because there are several people who ended up being credible witnesses that said that they heard a woman on the radio,
right,
shortwave radio, on frequencies that would have been multiples of the frequency that she was using. But they were in, like,
weird places.
Toronto or St. Petersburg, Florida, or, I mean, just Whoa. Crazy places.
It's pretty interesting.
It is.
I don't know these crazy radio facts.
I so would never have known that.
I am going to school you on some radio.
Yeah.
Because this is actually really interesting. The Itasca transmitted on 3105, but it did not have voice capability on 6210. So it didn't have the voice capability during the day, but it could have voice capability on the night frequency. To make multiple transmissions, Amelia's electroplane needed to run the right-hand generator-equipped engine to recharge the batteries for the radio. Okay?
Yep.
The safest procedure is to transmit only when the engine is running and battery power is required to start the engine. So to run the engine, the propeller must be clear of obstructions and the water level must never reach the transmitter. So the fact that she was transmitting after they were sure that she went down means that the plane was above the level of the seawater.
All right.
Because if the plane was in the ocean, she would not have been able to transmit anything.
Right.
So that pretty much solidifies the fact that the plane went down somewhere with either a reef or dry land or an island or something.
Right.
Because she transmitted for several days. Let's see. I have to cut this out.
I'll do my best. I better write it down.
Sorry, my notes are a mess.
It's okay.
No, you're doing a great job.
I agree.
All right. Let's see. I am not sure what day that is, though. Okay, so on July 4th, she disappeared on July 2nd. She was supposed to land the evening of July 2nd. So July 3rd was mostly spent between the Coast Guard and Amelia trying to get in touch with each other. The Coast Guard trying to make sure that it was Amelia that they were hearing and not, you know, planes from the West Coast of the United States and stuff like that. On July 4th, according to a local newspaper, Dana Randolph of Rock Springs, Wyoming, heard a woman say, quote, "This is Amelia Earhart. Ship is on a reef south of the equator. Station KH9QQ." And KH9QQ was Amelia Earhart's call sign.
Huh.
The woman then began to give her location, but the signal faded out before it was given. This sequence was repeated an unknown number of times during a 25-minute period. So a local Department of Commerce radio operator investigated and verified the report and found that the call sign heard was KHAQQ, and the signal frequency was near 16,000 kilohertz, which is close to the fifth harmonic of 3105 kilohertz. So
it could have been her.
Very possible. Like, it makes sense that this woman would have been able to hear it because she was on a frequency that was close enough to one of the harmonic frequencies that it was possible.
Right.
Yeah, but it's pink.
You know.
You know why?
Why?
She's a ship, and she was in a plane. Checkmate, fake Amelia Earhart.
Wow, just, you are
just wait.
Something else, Acadia.
Yeah, Acadia, stop, like, ruining everybody's life.
Also, the possibility of a hoax was ruled out because the investigation that took place and the fact that the newspaper was published every other day meant that Miss Dana Randolph had not yet received the news of post-loss signals and stuff.
Right.
So, she shouldn't have known about the frequency and all right. of that jazz.
Right. She wouldn't have known how to fake it, in other words.
Right. Also on July 4th, a Mrs. Ernest Crabb of Toronto, Canada, said she heard fragments of a conversation between a woman and a man she believed to be Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on her 20-tube radio. She says she also heard a few sentences in what seemed to be Japanese breaking in. So, the explanation for this, when she heard it, it was actually at the same time that Dana Randolph heard hers in Rock Springs, Wyoming, during that day. There were two home radios with shortwave capability in 1937. And one of those was the one that Mrs. Crabb had.
Oh.
There was also a 50,000 watt Japanese station, JZL, in Tokyo at 17,785 kilohertz. So this could explain why Mrs. Crabb was tuning into that part of the band and why occasional Japanese sentences could be heard on 18,630 kilohertz. Because let me tell you, I did not know that shortwave radio people in the U.S., like, it was a thing for them to tune in Japanese radio stations.
Yep.
Yeah,
they
crazy.
Get them all over the world.
It is not, like, this is not the only lady who says that she heard Amelia Earhart because she was tuning in to the Japanese radio station.
This is a right. WJZL playing you all yes. Japanese hits and okay. soon to attack your country.
That is racist. That's racist.
Russian. isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is. It's crazy.
My brother had a shortwave radio for a little while, like when we were kids, and like you could get like a book of, oh, go to this, and you, there's some guy in fucking, I don't know, Siberia and shit like that. But yeah, you can, it was easier to get people from way far away than like people near you. It was like the opposite of the CB radio.
Because of the harmonics, because of the way that it like, you know, reflected off the ionosphere and stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
So we need to do an episode on number stations.
Yeah,
somebody write that down. All snap.
I'm writing it down. Yeah.
At the same time as the Wyoming and Toronto signals were heard, Pan American Airways radio direction finding stations, in Midway Island and in Oahu, Hawaii, heard weak carrier signals and a faint broad signal, which was apparently a voice. Unfortunately, the signals were too weak to take a bearing to figure out where they were coming from. So at this point, on the evening of the 4th, the Itasca began calling Earhart in voice with what's called a long count, and asking her to respond, and they continued to do it throughout the evening in 30-minute increments to try to, you know, catch her.
Right.
On July 5th, Oahu heard the request of to Earhart to send four dashes, and then heard four dashes on frequency 3105 immediately following the broadcast. They actually ended up asking the broadcaster to repeat the broadcast to verify the response. And the second time, they heard two dashes immediately following the second broadcast. So at this point, they were able to get a bearing of approximately 215 degrees on the source of the dashes. And I'm not even going to get into the bearings because that would be another 3 pages worth of notes. But suffice to say, they were trying to triangulate where she was. Like, the bearing is basically trying to figure out from multiple sources, you know, it's triangulating, you know, the cell phone tower so you can find out where she is and then go there and get her. But if the signal is too weak, you can't do it.
Right.
So, the Coast Guard also heard the dash responses in Honolulu. Let's see. The U.S. Navy radio station in Samoa heard three sets of dashes after a broadcast at 7 in the morning asking Earhart to respond. The first set was four dashes, the second set was four dashes, and the third set was a total of 8 dashes, four of which were very strong and were accompanied by an undistinguishable voice. And then what actually ended up happening is that transmissions continue to be picked up on an hourly schedule at 15 minutes past the hour, every hour. This was the same transmission schedule that Amelia Earhart had declared prior to leaving New Guinea en route to Howland Island.
Interesting.
Right?
Yep.
So, the Morse code transmission that they got from her. Yep. They think that it's from her. The characterization of the king was, quote, extremely poor, which makes sense because neither of them were proficient at Morse code.
Right.
And they probably had to write the message by writing down dots and dashes on paper and then transmitting it using the microphone push-to-talk button. The message said, 281 North Howland, call KHAQQ, beyond north, don't hold with us much longer, above water, shut off.
That doesn't sound that promising.
No.
It sounds like an overall negative situation.
Yeah.
It also exposes the trouble of Morse code.
Right?
You'd already drowned by the time you got the message out there.
I know.
Seriously.
Right, it's true.
So,
it's for nothing, Morse code.
Can you imagine Morse code 911?
Oh, God. Awful. Yeah, I'm already dead.
I mean, the weirdest television show ever. Okay, so on July 5th, Miss Ernest Crabb again heard the same sort of fragmentary conversation between a man and a woman that she had heard on the 4th. She also heard scraps of conversation in the voices of a man and a woman on July 6th. She was tuned into the same wavelength, 18,600 kilohertz, which on which for 2 days she believed that she had heard conversation between Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan. Now, also on July 6th, Thelma Lovelace of St. Stephen's, New Brunswick, Canada, was listening to shortwave on her radio sometime before 8 a.m.
James, for Christ's sake.
I know.
Out of control.
While tuning around a frequency where she usually heard a program of Japanese music every morning, she heard a voice loud and clear saying, "Can you read me? Can you read me? This is Amelia Earhart. This is Amelia Earhart. Please come in." Earhart then gets her latitude and longitude, which Thelma wrote in a book, and continued, "We have taken in water. My navigator is badly hurt. We are in need of medical care and must have help. We can't hold on much longer."
Aww.
So, Thelma, when she was interviewed, said that she was unable to find the book in which she wrote the coordinates down.
However, I know.
It gets better than that, though.
Come on, Thelma. You should do
her that. Radio, like, the family still has the radio. And so a relative provided photos to the aircraft recovery people. And there was one Japanese shortwave station that would have been inside the harmonic range
of the radio
of her radio and Amelia Earhart's signal.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, so
interesting.
It's probable or possible that she heard it.
So now, when did she come out? When did she come out with this?
Right.
It was... Where did it go?
Like, are we talking about, like, she came up with this...
She was interviewed later.
In, like, 1997? Or are we talking about...
Like, something like later? That. Because I don't have the exact date, but I know it was years and years later when it was too late. Because a lot of these people, they either sat and, like, listened and got all the information that they could. And then, you know, at the time, you know, what are you going to do? Call 911? So
I don't know.
They're like...
That's what I'm asking. I'm like, what?
They had to get a hold of somebody in authority. And in one case, one woman was told that there were ships in the area and everything was under control.
Wow.
So they didn't want her information.
Yeah. See, because, nice. Like, on the one hand, you'd be like, well, who do you call? But on the other hand, like, I'm sure that you could probably just call the president directly if you knew his number.
probably,
you know what I mean? Like, you just pick up the phone and go, Coast Guard? And they would just, like, connect you to the Coast Guard or whatever.
Yeah, like, president's phone number was probably, like, #NAM567.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Connect me to Blue Bonnet 7. Yeah. I'm going to save Amelia Earhart.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
See, Katie and I would have had it like that, man.
That's right.
Listen to me, Mabel, I don't have time.
All right. So, let's take a quick recess because I have to pee.
Okay. I'm going to smoke. I've been doing other things.
I'm sorry.
Fine, but...
So, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Okay.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yes. Yeah, I've been doing all sorts of things. I've been doing dishes.
I hear it all.
Acadia's been bitching about it, and meanwhile, I can't hear any of it.
I've been muting it, so I don't know what you're talking about.
He's a moron. Like, he's a moron.
The crickets, and then I
that I heard, and then she muted it.
No,
you
can
hear the crickets. Oh shit! I had it muted most of the time. I was hoping you guys couldn't hear it.
And then,
I only unmuted it like every once in a while, just so because I wanted to like be like, oh
and then I hear.
Yeah, then he's like, she's chomping on nachos, and I'm like, it's fine, I don't hear anything. And he's like, I hear it, and I'm like, well, I don't hear it, so it doesn't matter.
Didn't I say? Why are you being such a bitch? Didn't I say at the beginning of the show?
I know, and I couldn't hear it then. The takeaway from this whole thing is why Jen thinks if she can't hear
because my computer is recording it. You fucking moron.
What? From the whole thing.
Because I'm recording it.
I said to message me and I'll keep myself muted.
No, you blocked me.
Oh, you're such a fucking bitch. I did not block you. I never blocked you. I'm blocking you now.
Oh, God.
Okay, so, like, I went to the bathroom and it's all dark in the hallway and stuff. And I flip the light on and I run in there and the freaking Siamese cat is in there and he's like, meow. Like,
you scared the shit out of you?
And I was just like, no, he doesn't scare me. I'm just like, ugh. Because earlier when I left to go get my gloves.
Yes.
And what a strange sentence.
And my hair done. Because I can't curl it on my own.
Yeah, Acadia, Christy went and had her hair done. At a salon.
Acadia appreciated all of our efforts enough. I was expecting
more
enthusiasm.
I asked him. He was like, he was definitely surprised.
Yeah,
I wanted to figure out a way. It's the hard part was that it was such a surprise, but then I also wanted to figure out a way to like, that's what, and if we had done the introduce ourselves, then you would have been like front and center because like one person talking at a time. Right, but yeah. I didn't want to like kind of direct during the spontaneous part, but it was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
It was
awesome. No, so
I expected your eyebrows to be way bushier after the surprise.
Well, I was trying to restrain myself.
I wanted to be like this.
like when you get surprised, they're like, ah!
Yes, they're sentient. That's I guess what we're saying
like
now.
The guy from, like, what is it? Pan's Labyrinth or
Pan's Labyrinth. Yeah,
that's such a scary monster.
Just like jazz hands, but jazz eyebrows. Like,
yes, exactly.
So anyway, this is like, you'll think this is funny. So earlier I opened up the closet because I always leave the closet shut because
the Siamese cat
is declawed and he has litter box issues.
Right.
So
monsters left.
I didn't declaw him, by the way. The ex-wife did. But I threw open the closet door and I went in my closet and was like, do I have a dress? Yes, I have a dress. Okay, I'm good. And I need like a button-up shirt because I can't take my t-shirt off over my new hair and like all this other stuff. And so, and the lady was like, you need to get here now. And I was like, okay. So I shut the closet door and like latched it and left. And then
I come back
and like, I was gone for like an hour. Right. And I came back and I sat down and I was like, gotta write. Oh my God, my script. And then it like, the power went out. Like we blew a breaker in the office, like in this room, like three times. Oh, and I was about to cry because I was like, Christy. No. Oh. And so I run into the bedroom. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to get dressed and I'm going to do my makeup and then I'm going to write. And because then I'll be ready and it'll be fine. And I get in the bedroom and I hear, because the stupid fucker wanted to go in the closet instead of using the litter box. And so I open it up. I'm like, you asshole. And he walks out. He pooped in the closet.
Of course he did. Oh, my God. Of course he
did. And I just looked him straight in the eye, and I was like, I hate you.
Fucking cats, man.
He's
the worst. Oh my gosh.
And then he gets all snuggly at night and he's really soft and sweet and everything. And I'm like, but
no, you're an asshole.
Asshole.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready? Back at it.
Back at it.
I'm muting myself so I can go smoke and Acadia won't get all bitchy.
Okay.
Well, about the crickets.
I don't know why you didn't just tell me about the.
Jesus.
I had myself muted for the most of the time, and
the only reason I
clicked over to see what it was. Apartment.
I'm like, what the fuck? How are there crickets here?
It's ambience.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Then I flipped like, over to the hangout.
That's the story.
And there's like darkness. You were just
a creeper lurking in somebody's bushes.
Like a porch light.
Maybe I'm adding to the story.
Maybe.
Maybe you're actually
Maybe
committing a crime.
Maybe she's the non-miss in my tiara.
That's right.
That's right. Oh. All right.
How fucking great would it be if you were just... if your thing was just you outside smoking, and then we looked at Jen, and you were out her, outside her window.
Oh, that would be so scary. Oh, we
See,
have to do
we
that.
Need to, like,
we have to do that.
We need to do that. Like, on purpose.
Yeah.
Right?
So great. That, you know.
Like, I'm imagining, like, the Burger King guy, like, outside the window.
So you're holding the phone and you're smoking, and then you just like turn the phone and you until it can see in the
and
window.
Jen at the back. Oh,
and all you see awesome. Is like the cherry of the cigarette.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
We're a bunch of creeps.
That's gold.
Oh, we're such creepers. What's wrong?
All right.
All right. Back
so
to
now
the
we
story.
Get to the good
I'm
story.
I'm muting myself for a while.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Carry on.
All right.
So, BNF's going to love this name. Betty Clank.
Oh.
Classic. Oh, Betty.
In St. Petersburg, Florida, was a teenager in 1937 and often spent the afternoon listening to her family's shortwave radio, which was hooked up to a powerful antenna that her father had rigged up, like, all the way out to the street or something like that.
Of course.
So she kept a notebook handy to jot down the titles and lyrics of songs she liked, and when she wasn't jotting stuff down, she would doodle and, like, draw the faces of celebrities and all kinds of stuff because she was a teenager. So,
listen to Hot Japan 106.
Stop being racist.
Never.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It doesn't count when it's Japan.
Yes, it does.
Oh my gosh.
Carry on.
So, long story short, she's sitting there on the afternoon of either July 5th or July 6th. It's not clear, but it was sometime after Amelia disappeared. And she is the woman in the clip in the intro talking about hearing Amelia on the radio. Because she, as far as I know, she is still alive. And she has her notebook. Take that, other lady.
Yeah, whatever your name was. Thelma.
Yeah, it was. It was Thelma. So, Betty remembered hearing a voice that she recognized, and the voice actually said, "This is Amelia Earhart. This is Amelia Earhart." Betty was one of these teenagers that was crazy about airplanes in the 30s, and so she was well aware of Earhart's flight around the world. She, when interviewed at 78 years old, she couldn't recall if she already knew that Earhart was missing, but it was clear to her that Amelia was in trouble from, you know, her voice and what she was saying. So Betty opened her notebook and started to make notes.
Wow, Betty, way to go.
Yeah, Betty is a rock star.
Anti-Thelma.
Yeah.
I know, right?
So, a lot of times the words came too fast for her to get everything, and she would often write only a word or two of what had been said so that she could hopefully recall it later so that she wouldn't miss anything else. She said the signal faded in and out. Sometimes it stopped altogether for several minutes, and other times it was distorted. But she literally sat there for about 3 hours and made notes, listening to Amelia Earhart and a man's voice, which we're assuming is Fred Noonan.
Nice.
She got the impression that the man had sustained a head injury and was delirious. She gathered that they had crashed on land, but there was also a great concern about rising water. The man would alternately struggle with Amelia and try to get the microphone away from her, or he would start to panic and try to get out of the airplane. So the transmissions continue to come in. until about 6:15 p.m. At 5:15, her father came home from work, and Betty excitedly told him to come listen. After a few minutes, her father ran next door to see if his neighbor could also hear it on his radio, but they didn't have the big badass antenna, so he couldn't get it. And later that evening, Betty's father reported the entire thing to the local Coast Guard station, but was told that the government had ships in the area and everything was under control.
Oh, that's how they get you.
It is.
So Betty kept her notebook her entire life and occasionally tried to get someone to pay attention to her claims of having heard Amelia Earhart on the radio. She wrote a letter to a man named Fred Gorner, and he wrote her a two-word response that said, not interested.
Fuck off.
Jesus.
So she had basically given up on thinking anyone would ever believe her, but a friend of hers saw the Aircraft Recovery's website and sent them an email, and that's how they got in touch with her. And she actually let them scan her notebook. And so on their website, which we will put a link, you know, on the show page, there are scans of the pages of her notebook with all her drawings and everything and all her notes. And the whole thing, like, really reads like a modern day 911 call. Like, it's not disturbing, but it's sad because, I mean, she would say, this is Amelia Earhart. She would say, this is Amelia Putman, because she was married, but she didn't use her married name for the most part.
Plus, nobody was looking for Amelia Putnam.
Right. Every now and then, the man would come in, like, on the radio and start saying stuff. They said stuff like, help us quick. Come here just a moment. Send us help. I need air. Let me out of here, from the man. And then at one point, and this is important to one of the theories, Betty said she heard words that sounded to her like New York City over and over. Like, it was repeated several times. New York City, New York City. And, you know, she wrote it down over and over and over. There was, like, the man and the woman would argue where he wanted to get out. She was trying to talk him out of getting out. They were talking about the water coming up. They were talking about, you know, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's just really interesting. And at the end, the notes from Betty, like, explaining stuff said, she said a few cuss words and sounds like she was having trouble getting water. So at the end, like, you could imagine that they were just completely losing hope, unfortunately. So, the reason that New York City is interesting is because one of the theories is that the airplane did not go down at Gardner Island. It went down on what was called Milley Atoll, which was very near to Jaluit Atoll, which at the time was occupied by the Japanese and was considered Japanese territory because of the war. So the reason that New York City is connected to Milley Atoll is because there is a shipwreck very close to Milley Atoll, and the name of the ship is the Norwich City. Which sounds an awful lot like New York City, right. If your reception is fuzzy.
Right.
So the thinking is that, you know, if they had to put the plane down safely, but they did not know what island they were on and did not have enough fuel to go anywhere, and didn't know the name, you know, of anything except the shipwreck, they would absolutely use the name of the shipwreck to try to let people know where they were located. What do you think of that?
I think that there's not really a good reason why people would be hearing all these things.
It's
not like, 2007 hashtag 2017 where like the internet at large decides to like play a prank or like there's 4chan or some shit. I mean, like,
right.
What would be the reason for all these people doing, you know what I mean? It doesn't really make any sense.
Mm-mm, it doesn't. And these are all like the only stuff that I've told you are the probable accounts. There are right. a whole bunch of accounts that were considered unreliable.
Right.
And so I skipped over many? Like four pages of those.
Yeah, right.
Because there were a lot of people, like once the word got out, that wanted, you know, their 15 minutes of fame and like, oh yeah, I heard it. And there was no way that, like, they weren't in the right area or it wasn't the right time of day or they weren't on the right frequency or, you know, any number of things.
Right.
Let's see. So
I just
that's the end of most of the evidence.
Authorities weren't monitoring. I mean, I realize how many different, you know, bands you could be listening to or anything like that, but it would seem to me that that would be like the first thing that they do.
Well, they were, but
or that there would have been a, in case of emergency, only use this channel, something or other. Like,
well, that's
I believe this happened. I just don't understand how there wasn't some kind of procedure in place for it.
I think there was,
you know,
but from the notes that the radio operators on the Itasca took, it looks like they could hear her, but she couldn't hear them. And they could only hear her, you know, intermittently, but they basically ditched protocol and started panicking. They ended up confusing time zones and writing down the wrong time stamps on stuff that came in. And, you know, basically, like, for one thing, at one point before she went down, Amelia had said, I need you to transmit to me so I can get a bearing on you. This is paraphrased. I'm going to whistle into, or no, she said, I'm going to let you get a bearing on me and then you need to transmit it to me, but I'm going to whistle into my speaker and then you need to transmit. Like, she's trying to give them instructions so that everybody can be on the same page. She's like, after you get the bearing, you need to transmit either now or on the half hour. And this was literally, like, it all happened, like, a couple minutes before the half hour. So not only did they, like, start confusing what time zone they were in because they were right near the break in the time zone, they started writing down the wrong timestamps on the transmissions that came in and then had to go back and correct them. And they would try to transmit when she was transmitting. You know, it was a big cluster. Like, they all started to panic when they realized that she didn't know where she was and she was going down, or that she had gone down. And the protocol was supposed to be to use one of these two frequencies that she was using. And they defaulted to the 3105, I believe, because the Itasca could actually communicate with voice on that frequency and not on the other one. And so, but she, like, there's no evidence that she heard anything the Itasca sent. Like, even the stuff that she sent afterward, she acted as though she had not gotten any replies, like everyone else had dropped off the face of the earth.
Wow.
So, the signals were actually triangulated at Gardner Island. Like, they traced the bearings to Gardner Island, but the fact that this, they decided that this Betty in St. Petersburg was credible, and if so, the New York thing is interesting because there's no reason for Amelia Earhart to say New York City over and over and over.
Right.
And if she had had a different, because they have no idea what happened, like which direction she went or anything after they lost contact with her near Howland Island. She could have gone north, she could have gone south, she could have been blown off course. She could have, you know, she most likely thought she was in one place and she wasn't. And so she was trying to get to somewhere else and that didn't show up. And the only thing that showed up was an island atoll that she had to put down on because she didn't have enough fuel to keep going and risk crashing. So with that said, the TIGER, which is the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, which is the coolest
acronym,
that's the word I'm looking for.
Eye of the Tiger.
Tiger.
I'm gonna start playing that song, actually.
Mute it. They actually have sent numerous expeditions out to Gardner Island, which is now known as Nikumaroro.
I hope it's not like Beetlejuice, because you just fucking cursed us.
Oh, I didn't. I said it different times. every single time, so...
Don't be saying it in the mirror.
No.
Another thing.
So, they've had cadaver dogs that went out there and found... scent, like, different dogs at different times of the day, found scent in the same place where someone had died, but they haven't been able to recover any bones or anything. There's a story that because Gardner Island was uninhabited at the time, but not long after that, you know, a couple dozen of the islanders actually went and settled there because their island was so packed full. There are stories that those people found the bones, and also found airplane parts and aluminum and stuff and used it for housing and making bowls or, you know, whatever, because that's what you do. But nobody, like, the bones were supposedly recovered and then subsequently lost. So that's great. and that's all hearsay anyway. Like, there's no confirmed reports that the people that said that they recovered the bones actually had them at any point.
Honey, do you have those bones?
Right?
They're in the back of the closet.
Listen, I'm bringing them to Betty Clank to have her examine them.
Betty.
One of the other theories, and the theory that was spurred on by this photograph that isn't actually them, was that they went down on Milly Atoll, which was very, very close to Japanese territory, and the Japanese apprehended them and took them to Saipan, where the prison was. And there are people on Saipan who are still alive or who were interviewed in like the 70s and the 80s who remember a woman dressed as a man. And a Caucasian woman dressed as a man and a Caucasian man, because they stood out so much because they weren't Japanese and they weren't Islander.
Right.
And one woman in particular remembers Amelia, or the woman, being taken to a hotel on Saipan where they kept their political prisoners. And the theory is that the Japanese thought that she was a spy, and so they took her to the political prisoner hotel, and this woman did laundry for the people at the hotel, and she was the only woman. And this woman also said that she saw the woman for several months. I want want to say several months. It may have been longer than that, but I'd have to go find it again. And the last, you know, couple weeks that she saw her, the woman would make numerous trips to the outhouse, and then she didn't see her anymore after that. And she was told that she died of dysentery. As far as Fred Noonan, that theory says that when they were captured, Noonan was actually sent to the military barracks, and Amelia was sent to Garapan prison for a short time before being moved to the hotel. But there are people on Saipan who say that they saw a woman of the correct description at that time on Saipan. But that's all bunk if you believe that she actually went down at Gardner Island like, you know, these tiger people do. So it's still completely up in the air.
So I'm looking into this whole tiger investigation of Gardner Island. And this is really interesting. Like, this old school photographic evidence that they have where... I'm looking at this photo from back in the day of the Bevington photo SS Norwich City in the background, where they believe that there is a piece of the plane actually coming out of the water, the landing gear, when they analyzed it at max resolution and all this other stuff. And
yeah, the other thing that was really interesting about the History Channel special, apart from the photograph, because we've already debunked that, was that they went to Millie Atoll and they actually looked up where the beach was in 1937, because it is not the same as where the beach is now.
Of course.
And so they went looking where the beach used to be, like in a line, to see if they could find any airplane parts or, you know, anything. And they actually found rolled aluminum. Like, it looked like, imagine a steel drum, you know, like, imagine like a steel drum with trash burning in it on the side of the road in New York City. But you know how on the edge they roll the aluminum so that it's not sharp? Mm-hmm. They do the same thing to airplanes, or at least they did in the 30s. I don't know about it now because I don't know a lot about airplanes, but they had this piece and it, like, the curve of it, even though it was all beat up, was the same type of curve as the wheel well where the landing gear came up and down out of the plane.
I think that's what I'm looking at now online. It says a scrap of metal found by Tiger, which probably belonged to Earhart's Lockheed Electra 10E. The most recent physical evidence was uncovered in 2014.
Yeah, that sounds about right as far as what I had seen. So it's a really interesting mystery, and it's still not solved. The Tiger people think that they're actually planning to go back to Gardner Island because they want to... There's apparently, they detected a debris field off the slope of the reef, like off the beach around the island. And the slope is really, really steep. And it goes down to like 300 meters before it levels out. And they detected that there is debris or something down there, but the instruments that they had at the time were not able to figure out like what it was or get down to that depth to actually see what it could be. So they want to go back because they think that the Electra is in the ocean off of Gardner Island.
Or aluminum is still exactly the way it was, wherever it is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that first...
Unless the Japanese took it to the Saipan and burned it.
Yeah. The first photo on this article that I'm looking at, with it's all about the new evidence, is initially of an old photo where And the photo that was taken is completely unrelated, but because of the location, they're saying that they uncovered this photo because it was of Gardner Island, and they believe that that the plane was crashed in this reef area, and that it's upside down, and that the
The landing gear?
Yeah, it's actually sticking
out of the water
in this old school picture.
Yeah, one of the other things that they found on Millie Atoll is wheels with like an axle between them, and they're metal. And there are three sets of them on the island or on the atoll that are consistent with like these. It's not a barge, but like a platform that you would put something on to like move it, to move something really big. Like you would put like a wooden, you know, kind of platform on top of these wheels, and then you could roll it instead of dragging whatever it was. And there's really no reason for those to be there.
Right.
So that was evidence toward the fact that the Japanese actually captured them and took the Electra to Saipan with them. But I don't know, because a lot of that hinged on that photo that's not legit.
Right.
So it's a puzzle.
What do you think the odds are that she was able to steer towards something that wasn't the ocean when the plane was originally crashing?
I think they're good, because she was like, by all accounts, she was extremely capable. And I think, like, she wasn't running out of gas to the point where the engines would have stalled and she would have had to, like, crash into the ocean. From what they've said, when she said she was running out of fuel, it meant that she needed to go ahead and find a place to land. But not that, you know, there was no mayday or anything like that. It had not gotten to that point. So I think it's very probable that she, if she could find a reef or something that was out of the water, at least, you know, for the most part, that she probably landed it. And then if they died there, it was because nobody found them.
Because obviously there was a lot of miscommunication about where they even were.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So it was definitely a Gilligan Island situation.
Yeah. And damn, Bob's it. Your uncle.
So.
Well.
I'm perfectly willing to blame Japan for the whole thing.
Of course you are.
As a matter of fact, I am half convinced now that they shot her plane down.
That's also one of the theories.
I'm with Acadia.
That she was avoiding the Japanese, but the fact that she was sending distress calls for like 3 days, three to four-ish days, that they have said are not, you know, completely fabricated, if you will, leads me to believe that she went down somewhere and she wasn't, if they shot her down, she wasn't found immediately.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are so, like, this handful of people that say that they saw someone that fits her description is really the kicker for me, because that, like, a lot of these people don't, like, they didn't know who she was. They didn't know why she was important. They knew she stood out. And there weren't a lot of Caucasian women that dressed like male pilots at that time. So,
right.
I don't know. I don't know. I could go either way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the fact that on the Gardner Island that they found, you know, signs that somebody had been cast away there. Right. And they say that somebody died there and there were bones and stuff, but I mean, it's possible that one of them died there and the other one was captured. I mean, there's all kinds of ways it could have gone.
Right.
Man.
Yeah.
But no matter what way you slice it,
Japan the U.S. is government. Terrible. Yeah, no matter what way you slice it, Japan was terrible. And the U.S. government kept their mouth shut if they knew anything at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we definitely are talking about a completely different time period. So what they could have known, what was possible. I mean, communications and all this other stuff. I mean, it was a lot more difficult.
So I've got some really interesting links to stuff I will put up on the post for the episode on the website so that everybody can go look, because I could not find that book on my own. I had to get linked to it from the Tiger website. So, but they very helpfully linked to it and said, nope, here it is. It's not the real thing. Sorry.
All right.
Right.
So, there you go.
Very That's cool. Very cool story. I mean, good I definitely story. Learned a lot more about that whole situation.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know anything.
I mean, I mean, is it just me that thought that she just disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle?
No, I did too. I was like, no, the Bermuda Triangle got her. What the heck?
No, guys, you have to listen to our Bermuda Triangle episode to find out that it's a bunch of nonsense.
That's true.
Did you know there's more than one triangle?
I know that, actually.
There's a couple. I can't remember their names right now because it's late, but but there are a couple of places on Earth that are like the Bermuda Triangle where stuff disappears.
Yeah, so what I've actually heard is that if you take the amount of space that the Bermuda Triangle supposedly, you know, takes up and put that in any area, you'll get the same amount of...
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. There's no more... There's no more... It's well, whatever. We're advertising for the Bermuda Triangle episode, basically. Go check that one out, guys. We don't want to ruin it for you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. But, yeah, I was going to say more stuff.
Killing the magic.
What's right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, you know what? Maybe I'm just giving them just the tip.
That's right.
Just the tip.
Just the tip. All right.
Just to see how it feels.
Exactly. Think about how it feels, and then if you want more, go check out the episode. Oh my god. What is life right now?
Oh.
All right. You guys get to hear the first of a series of
amazing commercials. Yes, listen right after we end here, folks. It's going to be amazing.
Don't turn it off yet.
Yep.
Because
oh my god, I'm so excited.
It's going to be great.
All right.
Thanks, fam. Right.
And if you want to hear more amazing stories like this, well-researched and well-told, then help us out by going to patreon.com/strangeful because we are poor.
Correct.
And we need things like web hosting and microphones.
Acadia has to eat ramen noodles now because he bought a new webcam.
It's very sad.
I have to eat ramen noodle.
I was going to say, he just eats the broth. And he just says the broth.
And Cinev needs she needs a swing set.
That's no, true. She does.
Don't piss on my tiara. She needs a swing set. I'm serious.
I know. Why can't, if you're buying ramen noodles, why can't Cinev buy a swing set for Cinev? What's the problem?
He needs a swing set. Unicorn. Oh my god, wait. Hold on.
Cinev is showing us a unicorn.
It's a radio show.
It's for us.
That's
now,
why I was dictating. What's wrong with you?
Dummy. Oh yeah, the unicorn farts and poops. No.
Always happy to end on a classy note.
That's right. Hey,
you give us some Patreon money, and if you give us enough money, I'll just cancel the show.
Oh, all right. Good night, kids.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Adios.
Bye.
This episode of Strangeful Things was brought to you in part by financial support from North Central Positronics, making tomorrow today, and by added support from listeners like you. Please visit patreon.com/strangeful to support the show, and thanks for listening.